So I get to finish out the Beatitudes for us this morning in our series on the Sermon on the Mount. So I get the final three Beatitudes. And as Lou said last week, they all center around peace. So I'm going to start by reading our passage this morning. It is Matthew 5, verses 9 through 12. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Blessed are the peacemakers. What does it mean to be a peacemaker? What does making peace look like anyway? It feels like this is a question that I have been personally trying to answer my entire life. So about 7 years ago, on a road trip with Lou, we were listening to an audiobook about the Enneagram. You guys heard of it? It's kind of like a personality test. Well, I found out on that trip that I am a 9, and the Enneagram calls the type 9s the peacemakers. We are peacemakers. I know. And I thought, I want to learn more about this. So I started doing more reading, and it helped make my life make a lot more sense. Because Enneagram 9s, they are obsessed with peace. We love stability, both in our relationships and in our environments. And that is why most of us are pretty calm and agreeable people. It is also why most of us are really good at avoiding conflict. We can sniff it out kind of like a drug dog. And if there's a conflict within a mile radius, at least for me, I would do everything in my power to get rid of the conflict or to run away from the conflict. So as a kid, I did this all the time. So my dad's side of the family, they used to have what they would call debates. I called them fights. But essentially, at any family gathering, they would purposefully move into a room, choose a topic, usually something political and inflammatory, and then they would verbally spar with each other. And I got caught in the corner when they were having one of these. I couldn't escape, you know, as a kid. And I remember in my grandma's living room, they're starting to talk about something, and their voices start to go up, and they start, like, moving their hands more. And I start moving my hands more, too, but it's like this. And I'm starting to sweat, and my heart is just pumping. And I remember thinking, like, why are they yelling at each other? Why do they hate each other? I don't understand. And so eventually I, like, ran out of the room and hung out in the dining room. And I'd poke my head in every once in a while to, like, see how it was going. Have they gone to blows yet? Like, how is this going to end? And eventually I poke my head in, and everyone is getting up, and they're laughing. And my grandma said, that was such a great discussion. It's like, that was not a great discussion. You people are insane. This is what you do for fun? I don't think so. I did not understand it. Because to me, it felt like conflict. And to me, it felt like we shouldn't be doing this. I hated conflict. I hated raised voices. I hated any kind of relational tension, and I could feel it acutely. It's like I had conflict radar. And so I came up with some strategies. Okay, strategy number one. Plan A is escape. Get out of there as quickly as possible. Okay, so if that didn't work, if I was trapped, then plan B, tune out. I became the queen of tuning out. I could get lost in a book, so much so that my friends would have a game to see, like, all the horrible things they could do to me while I was reading, because I did not notice. I would daydream. I would literally fall asleep in places that felt tense to me. Anywhere. No matter how loud, no matter how crazy, I would fall asleep. So that was my plan B. And I actually got along pretty well with these two strategies until, can you guess? Until I got married. Because as it turns out, you can't avoid or tune out conflict with someone as easily when you share a bed with them. So, and I also also found out that different people do conflict differently. Not everyone wanted to avoid it like me. My husband had the idea that if there was something going on between us, we would do something called talk it out. I had no idea what that was about, but I was not about it. So then I came up with plan C, which was just never let him find out there was anything going on between us, which worked brilliantly for about 2 months. And then he wised up to all of my I'm fines. And then a couple years after that, we started marriage counseling because we really needed it, because I didn't know how to do conflict. So we started marriage counseling, and boy, did I learn a lot. I learned that peace isn't actually the absence of conflict. I learned that marriage essentially is a giant conflict, at least conflict done well. I learned that there are many different ways of doing conflict, and that it's actually a skill that I needed to learn. I learned that relationships without conflict are relationships without real intimacy or real peace. So we started learning how to fight, but how to fight right, which is actually the title of a book that we use all the time with young couples just like us that teaches people how to have healthy conflict. It's by Dr. John Gottman. And now I'm a little bit better at conflict than I was at the beginning, but gosh, I am still learning a lot. But what does all this have to do with peacemaking? A friend told me once, and it was like revolutionary for me, peacemaking is not the same thing as peacekeeping. And that's what I was doing before. I was peacekeeping. I was putting a giant do not disturb sign on every relationship in my life. Don't touch it. Don't change it. Don't mess it up with talking about negative things. I was peacekeeping, and I was doing everything in my power to avoid conflict. But God had to teach me, and is still teaching me, that peacemaking is actually bringing about true peace, God's way, through conflict. That's peacemaking. But the words peacemaking and peacekeeping still sound way too similar, and so I needed to come up with a different way of thinking about it, so that I could change how I dealt with it. So I came up with a different word. It's a way cooler word, and I hope you guys adopt it too. Shalom forging. Okay? Because you have to make it sound hardcore so it's something you actually want to do. So shalom forging. We've talked about shalom before. It's the Hebrew word for peace, and it means things as they should be, things as God intended them to be, whole, repaired, shalom. And then the second half of that word, we're not just shalom making, we're shalom forging, because forging implies work to me. It implies hard work and sweat and a little bit of danger. And it's a fitting word for the kind of work it takes to set things right in a relationship or a situation. So, imagine with me for a moment, think about a metal forger or a blacksmith. Just picture them in your head. That sweet leather apron, okay, you know what I'm talking about? The sweat, black smudges everywhere, the resting hardcore face. This is who I picture. Do we have it up there? Yeah! Does anyone know what movie that's from? A Knight's Tale. Yeah. She was like the only lady forger, and she was so cool, and she's my favorite character from that movie. But once I saw this movie, I was like, oh, I want to be her. I want to be her. She's so cool. Blacksmiths are hardcore, though. They have to be strong and brave and precise as they literally bend metal to their will. It's hard work and hot work. Those forges have to be heated up to 3,000 degrees. And you have to know exactly when to put the metal in and when to take it out in order to work it so that it's perfectly durable or strong or whatever you need it to be. It's a science for, like, really, really buff people. Glass forges are crazy, too. My sister took a glass blowing class at UO quite a while ago, and she was basically melting a bunch of tiny rocks into lava at the end of a long stick and then blowing lava bubbles with them. That's glass blowing. I have no idea who came up with that for the first time, but it's nuts. And there's about 1,000 different ways that you can injure yourself as well. Like one wrong move and you just don't have skin anymore. So glass blowing is insane. And even if you're able to make something out of that lava, if you don't cool it down right, and in like a long process of cooling, if you don't do it right, it'll just shatter into a million pieces anyway. So both of these art forms, they are sweaty, they are messy, they are a dangerous battle to create something beautiful from chaos. Can you see why I relate this to peacemaking? Peacemaking is difficult, dangerous, and delicate work. And it is not for the faint of heart. It is for those that have a vision of something beautiful that could be made from the fragmented relationships in front of them. And they brave that heat and that exhaustion and that time that it would take to make it right. Peacemaking, shalom forging. Jesus thinks it's pretty hardcore. And he pronounces those blessed that undertake the work. Blessed are the shalom forgers. So, how does one forge shalom, you may ask? Well, this morning, we're going to look at it as a metaphor for forging a piece of artwork in a hot, hot oven. They're pretty similar, and it helps me to think about it when I'm going about forging shalom in my own life. So, number one, like any metalworking and glass blowing artist, you have to start with a vision. So, Ernie, thank you so much. Ernie let me borrow this because I went to his house and I saw it sitting on the table and it was so beautiful and so perfect for what I want to show you. But his friend Chase, who sometimes comes here, he wanted to give Ernie a gift. And I don't know if you can see it. I'm trying to put the light to it. But it is this most beautiful, intricate, blown glass work with like a scene in it, with a cross and a beautiful star and clouds and mountains and so much color, and it's so delicate. Chase had a vision for something that he wanted to give to Ernie. A beautiful, beautiful vision. And that is what peacemaking has to start with. You have to start with this idea of what it would look like if this relationship or if this situation or if this person were made whole the way that God intended it to be. So we start with a vision. But how on earth are you supposed to know what God's vision of shalom looks like in a situation? I'll give you an example. Just this last week, God gave me so many examples this week of peacemaking. Thank you. No thank you. But just this week, I disappointed somebody so deeply. They were really looking forward to doing something with me. Something really big that I had promised. But I could not do it anymore. There just was no way that I was going to be able to make it possible. And that person was really, really upset. My temptation was to solve the problem so they wouldn't be mad at me. To just figure out some way to give them something close to what they wanted so that we wouldn't be upset anymore. My view of shalom in the situation was to get rid of the tension as quickly as possible. So honestly, I left the room and I was on my phone shopping for something that I could buy that person so they wouldn't be upset with me anymore for disappointing them. And God tapped me on the shoulder and was like, Brianna, that's not shalom forging. That's escaping the problem. Like, then what the heck am I supposed to do? Like, this hurts. Like, you're supposed to tell them that you're sorry and then sit in the disappointment with them. It's like, good night, I don't want to do that. That's exactly what I did. They cried. I cried later on. Felt like a horrible person. And I grew up a little bit. See, my view of shalom was getting rid of the problem as quickly as possible. God's view of shalom was for me to mature and for that other person to mature. So tricky to figure out what God's version of shalom is and what our version of shalom is. So how do we tell the difference? Well, number one, get in the Word. I love that we're doing the Sermon on the Mount because the Sermon on the Mount literally is Jesus' vision of shalom for relationships on earth. This is his vision for what shalom could look like if everyone were to behave like this. Can you imagine if every single person loved their enemy? There wouldn't be any enemies anymore. So read the Sermon on the Mount. Study it more throughout the week. Immerse yourself in it. Read the Gospels. Look at how Jesus stepped into situations. Look at how he treated people. Look at how, what did he do in tense situations or when there were relational rifts? How does Jesus treat people in really tough spots? Read the epistles. Dude, the church was a mess. Have you noticed this? That every epistle is basically trying to solve all of these conflicts in the church because you get so many people from totally different backgrounds and you shove them into a tight-knit community together, and it's messy. The epistles are all about how do we have shalom? How do we have unity? How do we come together as a church when we frankly hate each other a lot of the time? God's view of shalom, we have to get it from his word, and we have to get it through prayer, from his spirit. When Jesus talks about enemies in the Sermon on the Mount, enemies are anybody that we're in conflict with, what does he tell us to do for them? Pray. Bring that situation before God, and he will start to shape your view of what it should look like. Okay? When Jesus talks about confronting another believer about their sin, he follows that up by telling us to ask, seek, knock, all metaphors for prayer. Bring that situation before God. He is the one who can tell you what shalom is actually going to look like. Because boy, do we have messed up versions of it in our head. So number one, we have to have a vision for shalom. And once we have a vision, any good artist gains the proper skills. So what are some shalom skills? Number one, okay, I was told once, and I always remember this, what is the difference between an amateur and a professional in any field? The professional will go back and take the time to fix their mistakes. I loved that. Because everybody makes mistakes, but the professional is the one who sees the mistake and takes the time to go back and make it right. If we want to be professional shalom forgers, we need to start by fixing our mistakes because, boy, are we going to make a lot of them. What does this look like? It looks like a sincere apology because, if we're honest, a lot of the peacemaking that I need to do is the result of my own sin and my own selfishness. So we start by learning how to apologize. Gosh, apologies are so hard. And even just getting the words out, I was wrong, I'm sorry, and then shutting up is like the hardest part, you know what I'm right? Because it's so easy to say, I'm so sorry, but you, or giving reasons why we did what we did, or giving caveats or excuses or explanations. The hardest thing that we can do is say, I'm sorry, I hurt you. And then stop talking. So that's a shalom skill. Fix your mistakes. The second shalom skill is sincere listening. Have I really listened to the other person? Not listened while forming a counter argument in my head or finding a loophole or an exaggeration in what they're saying, but just listening to try to understand them better. To imagine what it would be like them, even if it was just for 2 minutes. Try to put yourself in their shoes. This is so hard for me when I am pissed off with Lou. It's so hard to change your perspective. No, you need to understand how you hurt me. No, you need to understand how this affected me. And setting that down and imagining when I'm still mad, how it would have felt to be him. So, the other day, a fight. We were about to watch a family movie. And so, you know, we were trying to pick the movie, and it was taking a really long time. And I knew that it was taking an annoyingly long time. But then I look up, and, like, the door shuts, and Lou's just gone. It's like, oh, you're gone. You must be really mad because I'm taking a really long time. I know that I'm indecisive, but I must have just crossed the line. And so we didn't quite know what to do. It's like, well, we don't want to start without him because if he comes back, and then he'll be really mad that we started it without him. So we all just went to bed. And when he finally came back, I told him. I was like, you kind of wrecked our night. Like, you're so selfish. Why'd you do that? Like, that was totally uncalled for. You made me feel terrible and sad. And I could have left it at that, and I wanted to leave it at that. But once again, thanks, God, for making me preach on peacekeeping. He tapped me on the shoulder, and I realized, well, it's really not like Lou to do something like that. Like, it's not like him to just, like, walk out and not do something that the family was going to do without an explanation. Like, something else must be going on here. So I asked him about it. And gosh, was there a huge iceberg under that one thing that had nothing to do with the movie, had nothing to do with me. It had everything to do with something that was going on in his heart. So what could have ended, and honestly, because I hate conflict, what normally ends with like a grumpy good night, because I don't want to talk about it, ended with me seeing what it's like to be Lou for a hot second. And it completely changed my view of the whole situation. That's peacemaking. Setting down how you feel for a hot second and putting on how someone else feels, because it can completely change everything. Have you really listened to the other person? Not interrupting, not coming up with counterarguments, but just listening, because that is a skill, a shalom forging skill. Okay, number three, shalom humility. What is going to get you hurt most often in a glass-blowing or metalworking shop area? Cockiness, pride, stupidity, strutting in thinking that you know everything. You're good. You don't need the teacher's help anymore. I don't need to wear the gloves. I'm so good at this. I got it. We can do the same thing with peacemaking. My sister and I got to do a glass-blowing session at the beach one time. So she had taken the class a couple years before, and then we got to go to the beach to do some glass-blowing. And I was scared out of my mind. You look at the oven, and you're, like, looking into the gates of hell, and it's terrifying. But we go, and she tells the professor, like, oh, yeah, I took this whole class, and these are some things I made. And so the teacher's like, oh, great. Well, you don't need my help. She's like, yeah, no, I don't. I'm good. So I'm, like, listening to every dang word the teacher's telling me, because I don't want to burn my hands off. I want palms the rest of my life. But my sister kind of goes in, and she's ready to get her stuff out of the lava pit, and she puts her thing in, but she had her hand too far down on the pole. So she touches the outside of that, like, 3,000-degree oven. And then she's so embarrassed, because she had told the teacher that she knew what she was doing. She, like, pretended that it didn't happen and didn't tend to her wound at all. So you know how burns work? They just keep on burning unless you cool them down. She had a very bad wound on her hand because she went in and got cocky. And she'll tell you that. But we can do that same thing with shalom, right? You strut into a delicate situation, and it might be the worst move that you could ever make toward peace. Right? I know what needs to happen here. I understand this situation perfectly. I know what they need to do. If they would just listen to me, I could solve this whole thing. And you march in and you insert yourself where you may or may definitely not belong, and you get burned. Or worse, you burn someone else. Can you imagine if my sister had accidentally dropped her lava rod onto somebody's foot? Like, it could have been really, really bad. We can't get cocky in peacemaking. Maybe we don't actually understand the situation fully. Maybe we don't actually know what needs to happen here. Maybe we don't have the faintest idea what God would actually like that person to do. So let me give you an example. A while back, I made a whole lot of assumptions about a person. They had done something terrible. And I knew why. And do you ever do this, or is it just me? You have conversations with them in your head. Yeah? We're like, you're so cool, and you strut in so confident and like tell them all the things. And they're like, woe is me. You're so wise and right, and I will change my ways. So I did that all the time with this person. I had these mental conversations in my head. Lou would like walk in on me. He's like, what are you thinking about? It's like, oh, nothing. But eventually I met with that person, and God had me do a whole lot more listening and asking questions than I thought I was going to do in that meeting. And I came away from that meeting sad for that person. Devastated for the reasons why they thought they had to make the decisions that they had to make and the motivation that they had in doing it. God taught me a lot that day, and the main lesson being that I do not know as much as I think I know. We never should wade into conflict quickly or cockily. If we don't have any caution, then it is not the right time. Go back to steps 1 and 2, which is getting God's vision and getting some more skills before you wade in. All right, number 4. If we are going to forge shalom, Jesus tells us that we're going to have to be able to take the heat. Let me read this again. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. When you try to bring God's shalom to broken people, you are going to get pushback. Look at that passage that we just read. The persecution that Jesus names, they are all relational attacks that all lead to relational wounds. If people tell lies about us, it leads to people actually thinking that we are horrible people or that we did something horrible. We lose accountability. We lose closeness with family members or friends. We might even lose our job or have people cut ties with us altogether. People say, I just can't be your friend anymore. Or, I thought I knew you. These are all relational wounds. Or worst of all, they could just ghost us. No explanation, no fight even. Just radio silence that Satan loves to fill with 1,000 theories about what they think about us now. Has this happened to you? It happened to me a few years ago. I felt a deep and growing burden to have a hard conversation with somebody. You know me, I didn't want to do it. No, thank you. I made a lot of excuses to God, and they all sounded very biblical. I just need to forgive them. Nobody's perfect. I'm probably not understanding the situation completely. I have no idea what it would be like to be in their position. They probably don't even realize what they're doing is wrong. But the uneasiness in my soul began to grow, and it started making me physically ill. I developed a heart condition and started passing out because I was so stressed about having this conversation. Still, I tried to compensate for that person's behavior or explain it away, but God kept burdening me to say something. And eventually, God orchestrated a conversation that I could not escape. And it did not go well. At all. Everything that I had feared started coming true. That person got angry and defensive. Conversations got more and more heated. And I prayed more than I have ever prayed in my entire life. I prayed before our conversations, I prayed during our conversations, and I prayed after them. I tried to stay calm. I tried to be honest. I tried to understand their perspective and still express mine, but everything fell apart. Nasty rumors started floating around about me, and people started treating me differently. Close friends began to distance themselves, and others literally told me, I thought I knew you. But they did know me. They knew my heart, and they knew my intentions, and yet they chose to believe lies about with me without even talking to me about it first. I have rehearsed that situation in my head over and over again, trying to figure out what I had done wrong or how I could have avoided what happened. I prayed so much. I tried so hard. And yet, here I was, alone and destroyed, and it sure didn't feel like peace. And it still doesn't. But I am still trying to figure out what God wants me to do. I have run into that person several times since this happened. And every single time, God has given me the strength, I don't know where he got it, but he gave it to me, to go up and talk to that person, even when I wanted to run in the opposite direction. And I have also been able to talk with a few of those friends. And the conversations have been really, really hard. But I try to listen, and I pray a lot beforehand, and I speak. And God seems to be doing some repairs. Peacemaking is not easy work. It's not. Shalom forging is often extremely painful. But we should expect it to be painful. We should expect the heat and be ready for it. And it doesn't necessarily mean we did anything wrong. Maybe we did. And we can always pray and ask God for him to show us what that was. But also, maybe we didn't. Maybe people just don't like entering into conflict. I love that Jesus prepares us for that in this passage. He tells us that there will be pushback, and it will be lonely work a lot of the time. We will lose relationships and reputations. But God sees what we're doing, and he is proud of us. The pain we feel is the same pain the prophets felt in their lonely, godly work. They had to be faithful to say what God wanted them to say, no matter how much people hated them for it, and so do we. We cannot control the response. We can only be faithful in our delivery. So our final way to forge shalom is release shalom to God. In the end, we have to let the glass or the metal or that person do what it will do. It is no longer in your hands. You did your part. You have to wait as things cool down to see if it will shatter or become something beautiful. Ultimately, it's not up to you anymore. My sister said that this is the hardest part of glass making, because you put so much effort into working that glass and trying to make it exactly like you wanted, but then at some point, you have to set it in the cooling oven and walk away. And you don't know how it's going to turn out. You don't know if you're going to come back to a shattered mess or come back to a delicate wonder. You just don't know. And it is the same with peacemaking. We can work so hard and so carefully to say the right thing or say it in the right way or say it at the right time, but we just can't control what the other person is going to do. We might end up with a stronger, more beautiful intimacy in that relationship, or we might end up with pain and distance and a shattered relationship. We just don't know. That is why shalom forging is so terrifying. There's always a risk. We can't control the final outcome. You can't control what the other person will do. You can only control you. Peacemaking is work, start to finish. In Matthew 10:34, Jesus said, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth." That word there, bring, it's the Greek word for cast or to throw. Jesus is saying, don't think that I came to just throw peace down like confetti and leave, you know, like, peace. That's not how peace works. You can't just throw down peace on a situation. You have to get your hands dirty. You have to get your brow sweaty. You have to do the difficult and delicate work of forging peace. In Isaiah 2, there is this beautiful prophecy of what God's kingdom will look like. People from all over the world will come to live there, and God will sit as the great judge, resolving conflicts between everyone. And then it says in verse 4, and they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Those same swords that were once used to murder fathers and wives and children, those swords will be taken to the blacksmith, and she will heat her forge to 3,000 degrees, and she will put those swords in the fire until they are white hot, and then she will beat them blow after blow after blow, sweat pouring down her face, until those swords become gardening tools that these old enemies will use to create a community garden together in that neighborhood. That is shalom forging. It is bringing about peace at any cost. It will leave you weaponless. It will leave you open to attack. But unless someone is willing to put their sword in that fire, nothing good will ever grow in the garden. Every blow on that sword will take massive effort. I'm sorry. I hurt you. Is this going to kill everybody? I'm upset. Can we talk? I'm angry. I was wrong. Help me understand. You hurt me. What are you afraid of? This isn't right. I disagree. That is not how you should treat that person. I'm listening. Let's pray. I forgive you. But when the dust settles and it all cools down, you'll be able to grow something beautiful together. And it will reveal the very face of God to the world. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons and daughters of God himself. We will look like God to people when we forge shalom. We will look so much like him that people will know we are his kids even before we tell them. Peacemaking is evangelism in this broken and divided world. You want people to see God? Start forging peace. Start listening. Start apologizing. Start making people feel seen and heard and valued, even when you disagree with them. Start telling the truth, the difficult truth, in a way that is loving and kind. Start bringing people together that have nothing in common. Start forging peace. Because the world will see God when it sees unity between people that should never be able to get along. That is the shalom of God. And Jesus entrusted us with his vision of it. He entrusted us with his vision of shalom, like a delicate little work of glass art. And he set it into our hands. And he says, peace. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, do I give to you. Do not let your hearts be troubled, nor let them be fearful. And why? Because blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you. When people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil crap against you, because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Let me pray for us. Father God, you know how much I hate conflict. And I know I'm not the only one. I pray for anyone in this room who's in a conflict right now, or who knows they need to have one. Please give them your vision of what you want the relationship to look like. Please give them the skills that they need to go about working toward that vision. I pray that you give people boldness to apologize if they need to. I pray that you would give people the words to say if they need to have a difficult conversation. I pray that you'd help people to listen and put themselves in the other person's shoes. I pray you'd help them to be brave and do the really hard thing that you're asking them to do. Lord, you had me preach this for a reason. And so I pray that it would give strength and boldness to someone in this room who really, really needs help forging peace in their life. And most of all, God, I pray that if someone feels lonely or like they're doing this totally wrong because they got backlash, Lord, I pray that you would give that person encouragement, that you see them, you see the hard work that they're putting into this relationship, and that you are celebrating that in heaven. You see their intention and you see their heart, and they're not alone, and it wasn't for no reason that you had them enter into that conflict. Please help us all to have your vision of shalom. I pray all of this in Jesus' name. Amen.